So this morning we are going to talk about heart disease. And heart disease, as you know, when I am talking about heart disease, I'm talking now of coronary artery disease and not rheumatic heart disease and not congenital heart disease. There's so many kinds of heart disease, but the one that is really the number one killer of our civilization, the epidemic of our culture, is coronary artery disease, a condition where there is progressive narrowing of the coronary blood vessels, ultimately leading to a myocardial infarction, which means death of the muscle of the heart, and leading ultimately to death. This is the number one problem of our civilization. The other significant problems of our civilization are automobile accidents, addictions, cancer, and now AIDS. But if you combine all of them, this still exceeds everything else. So this is indeed the number one killer in our civilization. Approximately 1.5 million Americans will have myocardial infarction this year, of which 500,000 will die, and at least 300,000 people in the United States will have a coronary bypass graft operation, which these days costs anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000. So you can see the huge impact of this disease on our society. When I was in medical school, we were taught that these were the conventional risk factors for coronary artery disease. And if you ask the American Heart Association, even today they will say that these are the risk factors: smoking, hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, obesity, and a family history of coronary artery disease. And yet, the data shows otherwise. This is what is taught to us in medical schools, and even is the official statement of the American Heart Association. But the data that is emerging right now says that actually more than 60% of patients who will die of a heart attack before the age of 65, which means the majority of people who will die of a heart attack before the age of 65 actually do not have any of these risk factors. So despite the fact that these indeed are risk factors, the perplexing data still is that the majority of people who are dying of heart attacks do not have any of the standard risk factors for heart disease. So what's going on? In fact, when this kind of data started to emerge, there was an attempt, starting in Framingham, Massachusetts, which is where I took my training in that Massachusetts area, and this was a big thing. You know, about 15, 20 years ago, there was an attempt to decrease the risk factors of heart disease through intervention. You take people and you make them stop smoking, you make them lose weight, you regulate their blood pressure, you bring down their cholesterol levels, and then what you expect is that they will have a lower incidence of heart disease. Because, obviously, if you're cutting down the risk factors, then you should have a lower incidence of heart disease, you should have a lower incidence of heart attacks and mortality. Well, this was a very famous study done in Massachusetts 15 years ago, where intervention showed minimal reduction in heart disease and overall increase in mortality in those people who had intervention of risk factors. A more recent study was done in Sweden, where people with high risk factors underwent intervention, particularly things that we think we can control: smoking, hypertension, high cholesterol, obesity, change their eating habits, were introduced to an exercise program, etc. And the mortality was significantly higher in those people who had intervention of risk factors. And this study was published in the British Medical Journal about 5-6 years ago, and the editor said that probably the hassle factor or the stress that was induced in these people as a result of wanting to change the risk factors was responsible for the even higher mortality in those people who had these interventions. Now, having said that, there's no doubt that there are other studies that show if you use effective methods to, say, decrease cholesterol, that does alter the incidence of heart disease. But overall, the results of intervention in coronary artery disease prevention programs have been extremely disappointing. And my feeling when I look at this data is that all the interventions are motivated by fear. Patients are told that if you don't stop smoking, you're definitely going to get a heart attack or cancer or something else. They're told that you've got to lower that cholesterol. In fact, if you go around airports in this country, which I do a lot, you see all these big posters from the American Heart Association that says, "Have you checked your cholesterol today?" Okay. And, you know, that's pretty scary. So everybody's being motivated by fear, and the fear itself has its own biological response. So one of the things that we have not really grasped fully in medicine, even in the prevention programs, is that motivation by fear may in fact exacerbate the problem, whatever that problem is, whether it's heart disease or anything else. If on the other hand, your motivation comes out of inspiration, which is different than motivation. In fact, the word inspiration literally means to be in spirit. Then the change of behavior comes out of the experience of joy. Joy becomes the motivating factor. And then, of course, the strategy will work very effectively. Fear-based strategies do not work. Whether they are in hypertension or cholesterol, that's been proven over and over again. Athletes or people who run every day because they think it's good for them, not because they enjoy it, are likely to drop dead on the track. And this is true of any kind of behavior that we want to change. So behavioral modification programs in general have been extremely disappointing because the fear generates its own physiology. So what's the solution? The solution is to look again at what are the psychological factors that influence behavior. After all, if you have obesity, if you're smoking, if you have addictive behavior, it's probably a substitute for something that you're seeking, you just don't know how to find it. My experience with patients with addiction has always reinforced my feeling that addiction and addictive behaviors in general are a second-class substitute for the loss of exaltation. The exaltation and the joy that comes from the experience of the spirit. And human behavior in general is motivated only by two things. And I'm saying in general, because most people, unless they're in love or unless they have a predisposition to spiritual seeking, are not aware of that. So in general, human behavior is motivated by two things: the pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. And you'll see that's what most human beings are doing all the time. We're either avoiding pain or we are pursuing pleasure. And sometimes our first experience of pleasure is through substance use, whether it's cigarettes or alcohol or drugs or sex or any other experience that gives us a temporary high. The human nervous system is such that it associates that experience, even if once, with intense pleasure, then it gets hooked, you might say, to the memory of that experience. And so addiction is really addiction to a memory, always. It's not to the substance, it's to the memory. And long after the stimulus has ceased to be pleasurable, the physical body, the cells of the physical body, the nervous system, are still hooked to the memory. The body is the incarnation of memory. There is no way you can erase that memory. So theoretically, you cannot get rid of addictive behavior by trying to get rid of the memory of pleasure. You might have stopped smoking for 20 years or stopped drinking for 20 years if you have a problem with alcoholism, but that memory will never go away. And there was always the chance that, given the right neuroassociative conditioning, go right back to it. Because it's in your cells. You cannot erase memories from the cells. So what's the solution if you can't erase memories? The only solution is to create a new memory which is more powerful than the old memory. The old memory is never lost. It is overshadowed by the new memory. When you introduce the new experience, the new karmic episode, it must be of such power and of such pleasurable significance to you that it has to overshadow the old memory. That's less important, even though that old memory never goes away. And therefore the Ayurvedic approaches to addictive behaviors are basically to reintroduce the whole idea that we live in a sensuous and sensual universe, and that the experience of pure spirit is exaltation. Exaltation or ecstasy is the primary experience of life. It's the original primordial energy state. In fact, the word ecstasy comes from the word ektasis, which means to step out of space-time into the experience of unity consciousness, or what's called a peak experience, or pure joy, exaltation of spirit. They all mean the same thing. So all the strategies are, of course, elimination of toxins, but also through sensory stimulation, through sensory modulation, through the five senses, to enhance the experience of pleasure, to reinterpret the experience of pleasure, and ultimately to give us the experience of pure spirit or higher states of consciousness. Since we are on the topic of ecstasy, I'm just going to say a little bit about it. There are three kinds of ecstasy. The first kind is physical ecstasy. And physical ecstasy comes from physical experience, which is sensory. It comes through sound, through touch, through sight, through taste, through smell. And we do live in a sensuous universe, and when God decided to create the universe, the Vedic conceptress, she had this idea, we must make it a lot of fun. And therefore, sensory gratification is really an important thing. As long as it's done with pure awareness, it's done with attention, it's done with present moment, life-centered awareness, then you have a chance of really experiencing the exquisite exaltation that comes from being touched or being loved or making love or eating or anything that has anything to do with the senses. The second kind of ecstasy is what is called mystical or archetypal ecstasy. And this is a very interesting notion only introduced in this century by Carl Jung, the great psychologist, but actually a concept that is very, very much part of all traditional cultures. The word mystical, myth, mythology, there are two roots to that word. Myth is related again to the word mother, which refers to the womb of creation. Logos, of course, is knowledge. So mythology is the knowledge of creation. And Joseph Campbell, who was one of the modern authorities on mythology, said that mythology is truer than history. History is just another form of journalism, and we know how reliable that is. But mythology really captures the true essence of the consciousness of a collective soul. So beneath the level of our conscious awareness, our unconscious motivations dwell in the mythical world, which means that deep inside us, in our consciousness, in our psyche, there are gods and goddesses in embryo, and they yearn to be born, they yearn to lift us out of the ordinary, the humdrum, the trivial, the mundane level of existence. That we know this without knowing it, in that we act out our unconscious or mythical motivations, sometimes even without bringing them into our conscious awareness. Something as mundane or as banal as striving to succeed in a corporate takeover bid actually partakes of the heroic journey as much as the Argonauts seeking the Golden Fleece. Climbing Mount Everest is driven by the same ambition to reach the abode of gods as Icarus flying toward the sun. So, in mythical terms, ecstasy is a sacred journey that we undertake into the underworld, into the subconscious. And when we lose that mythology as part of our bankrupt culture, then we lose the experience of ecstasy. And that's why kids will join gangs, because gangs have mythology, gangs have ritual, gangs have initiation, gangs have leadership, gangs have imagination. It takes us as much imagination to be a gang leader as it takes to be Krishna or to be Ulysses or to be Rama or to be Achilles. So we need to really start bringing ritual into our life. We now need to start bringing initiation, rites of passage, the traditional things that made life so mysterious, enchanting, and ecstatic. And the third type of ecstasy is what I've already referred to, exaltation of spirit, or spiritual ecstasy, or sacred ecstasy, or divine ecstasy, which is the experience of God, which is the experience of the divine within us and higher states of consciousness. You know, in the Book of Solomon, which goes back to the birth of Judeo-Christianity, there's a beautiful ode by Solomon that, in a sense, describes all these three kinds of ecstasies. In one of his songs, Solomon says, "He split me and tore my heart open and filled me with love. You poured your spirit into mine. I knew you as I know myself. My eyes are radiant with your light. My nostrils are filled with your fragrance. My ears delight in your music. And my face is covered with your dew." So much sensuousness. And it says, "You have made me see all things shining. You have made me see all things new. I know you as I know myself." Now that's a pretty good description of the different kinds of ecstasy that we have access to. And it's part of every tradition, as you can see. So that's the ultimate solution for these behaviors. Coming back to trivial and mundane, when you start looking at heart disease risk factors, when I was in medical school, everybody said type A behavior. You know, type A behavior is what makes you have heart attacks. Type A behavior is characterized by these characteristics: hard driving people, competitive, need for recognition, time pressure, deadline pressure, hypermental and hyperphysical state. And of course then, all kinds of programs were introduced, once again, to reduce type A behavior. And what happened is, people had even more heart attacks. So, in fact, nobody believes that type A behavior is related to heart disease. But there is one component of type A behavior which is related to heart disease, and that is hostility. And there are many, many studies now, especially from Duke University, from other centers in the world, that say this is the risk factor for heart disease. This and one other. I'll come to that in a moment. But this is the number one risk factor for heart disease. Hostility. This was an interesting study. 20% of hostile lawyers were dead at the age of 50. And a prospective study that was done. There are studies that have done angiograms and so on. And these are the three components that are most important when you examine people with hostility. A general cynical mistrust of others. A state of free-floating hostility. And frequent behavior patterns of aggression. Cynical mistrust, free-floating hostility, and frequent aggressive behavior, aggressive responding to people. Now, in your syllabus, we have actually done a little test, so you might be able to measure your own hostility level. You might want to look at that later, okay? Not right now. There are studies that show that when people feel supported, when they feel loved, when they feel cared for, that will immediately reduce the risk factor of death from heart disease. So there is this amazing study where a monthly phone call by a nurse to post-infarction patients, just one phone call lasting less than a minute, the nurse calls up the patient, says, "Mr. Smith, we are thinking of you. We want you to know that we are always here for you, we care about you, we love you." That will reduce the death in a post-infarction patient by 50%. Imagine if you had a drug that did that, and you didn't use it, you'd be sued for malpractice. And yet, this will do that. There are other studies, of course, that show that loving support by a spouse will reduce the incidence of post-infarction death. A study from Israel where patients were asked after a heart attack only one question: do you think your wife loves you or not? If the answer was yes, there was an 80% better survival rate. The second most important risk factor for heart disease is job dissatisfaction. More people die in our civilization on Monday morning at 9 o'clock than any other time. And that's an extraordinary and very unique accomplishment for which only the human species can take credit, because presumably no other animal knows the difference between Monday and Tuesday. So here again we see that the fear that's generated by people in their consciousness, because they hate what they're doing, they have no purpose in their job, they do not get fulfillment, accelerates the whole problem. Just for completion, I'm going to talk for a few minutes on diet. Because over the years, I've personally become convinced, don't ask me why, and a lot of it has to do with my interactions with patients, and measurement of cholesterol, I've personally become convinced that diet has very little to do with heart disease. And, you know, I probably would be crucified by the establishment for saying this. But it's so difficult to, first of all, change people's diet. You're a different kind of group. You're very inspired, and that's your motivation for changing comes from inspiration. So you're learning about Vata, Pitta, Kapha, and you think this is wonderful, and there's a lot of joy in doing that. You'll do extremely well, and your diet will in fact change your physiology. But if you do that to someone out there who's not motivated, who's not inspired, and you tell them, better change your diet, otherwise you'll get into trouble, it's not going to work, I'm telling you, even if they follow the diet. It has to come from deep inside, that need for wanting to change. So in a clinical practice, when you give people diets, and I've done that over the years, and forced them to change, even things like cholesterol and all don't change. Because their whole psychophysiology is such that you start to secrete neuropeptides that transfer the cholesterol into a different metabolic pathway. And also when you give drugs, powerful drugs like Mevacor and other cholesterol-lowering agents, the reduction in cholesterol is not that significant, 10%, 15%, at most, which is hardly what you want in people who have really high cholesterol levels. So there's limited success. Dr. Dean Ornish has been able to reduce stenosis, you know, coronary artery disease as measured by angiography by 40% in patients in whom he puts them on a diet which has only 10% fat. Now that's very impressive when you look at that, but then go ask Dr. Ornish, how many people stick to that diet? It's a very small component of people who are very highly motivated and they are actually offering a lot of loving support to each other. By and large, for practical purposes, it's totally impractical. So, diet is important, but the motivation for change in diet has to come from another level. And think, you probably heard me talk about this many, many times, you know. This classic study that was published in the journal Science in 1970, where scientists were feeding diets that were extremely high in cholesterol to rabbits. But in one group, the technician who was feeding these rabbits, he would take them out of their cages, he would pet their rabbits and cuddle them and tickle them and kiss them before feeding the same poisonous diet. But now as a result of that, they had a very significant decrease in fatty deposits, in atherosclerosis, and a much lower incidence of heart disease. So just the act of cuddling and touching and loving these rabbits change the metabolism of cholesterol. And today there is data, good data, that shows that meditation twice a day will lower your cholesterol much more significantly than any change in your diet. That accountants will have their cholesterol levels go up by approximately 40% before tax time because they feel all the deadline and the pressure and the frustration of having to do all this work in such a short time. Many studies that show that your mental state is more important in lowering or exacerbating your cholesterol levels than anything else. From an Ayurvedic perspective, the most important thing that you can do to prevent heart disease is to get in touch with dharma, your purpose in life. The understanding of what your unique talents are, because everyone who has life has a unique talent. There are no spare parts in the universe. That's the Vedic concept. And when that unique talent is expressed in service to others, that translates into an extremely healthy physiology. If you are, you know, every organization has its mission statement, and our organization, Infinite Possibilities, we went on a retreat a few years ago with all our teachers, and we spent a week coming up with our mission statement, ended up with just four words: to heal, to serve, to transform, to love. And I think, you know, if you really think about it, that I can't think what would be anybody else's mission. That's probably everyone's mission, at least I think. To heal, to love, to transform, to serve. If that is our dharma, I think that in itself is more than enough. We'll move on now to a very interesting area that fascinates me a lot, and I want to talk about it a little bit as it pertains to heart disease. One of the things that physiologists have become aware of in the last several years is that our bodies, our physical bodies, are magnets, and they are part of the magnetic field of the earth. That everything in our physical body has electrical or electromagnetic energy. We know that there are only four types of energies in the universe: electromagnetic energy, gravity, strong and weak forces. Electromagnetic energy seems to be all pervasive, it's everywhere. The Earth is a magnet with a north pole and a south pole, and there are lines of electromagnetic radiation that surround the Earth and permeate the fields of our atmosphere. Our physical body is also a magnet. everywhere that we see. For even the DNA has polarities. It has a north pole and a south pole. Our heart has a pacemaker from where the electromagnetic energy emerges. Our brain waves produce electricity. Nerve impulses are transmitted through electromagnetic waves of energy. So each cell in the body has its own electromagnetic energy that it generates. In the human body, the two places where electromagnetic energy is generated very significantly, it's generated everywhere else as well, is in the brain and in the heart. One of the properties of that electromagnetic field is known as coherence. Coherence. Coherence is a quality of either heart wave or brain wave or the electromagnetic waves of any part of our body. Brain wave coherence, for example, is defined as the constancy of relationship of brain waves at a specified frequency when they're measured from different parts of the scalp. When you record an EEG, you can record the brain waves from different parts of the scalp at a certain frequency. And in most people, you'll find that there is no constancy of relationship, which means this part and this part and this part, they all have their own chaotic activity without any relationship to each other, because of a turbulent internal dialogue, basically. When you have high brainwave coherence, which means there's constancy of relationship, which means the brainwaves are marching in step to each other, they have a relationship to each other, then there's creativity, there's alertness, there's better memory, there is better healing ability, there is better attention span. All these things correlate with high brainwave coherence. The heart actually also generates its own electricity. And the part of the heart that generates the electricity is called the pacemaker. It's found in a place that is located in one of the little chambers of the heart called the atrium. And that place from where this electricity is generated, it's called the sinoatrial node. And then the electricity spreads out from there into the two chambers that are called the atria, and then into the ventricles, and that's the electricity that makes the heart pump. Over the years, people have had insights that actually the heart is the master oscillator of the body. It is the seat of this electromagnetic intelligence, if you will. You can take a human heart or any heart out of the body, give it the right nutrients, put it in the nice medium where all the nutrients are supplied, and the heart will continue to beat even outside the body. It's independent, in a sense, of what's happening in the body. You provide the right nutrients, the heart has its own automaticity, it has its own intelligence, and it will continue to beat forever if you give it the right conditions. So it is the master oscillator of the body. It generates this electricity that makes it pump, but it also creates an electromagnetic field around it. There are technologies that allow you to measure the coherence of the electromagnetic field around the heart, which spreads into the whole body, incidentally. There's an instrument called Fourier analysis. What it does is it takes the electrocardiogram, which is the normal way to measure the electrical activity of the heart, and you put it through this computer analysis, and that electrocardiogram will then be translated into this electrical field that you can actually see and observe and measure and see the coherence of. The coherence of the heart and the coherence of the brain, when they're both coherent, that creates a coherent electromagnetic field around the whole body. And there is this suggestion that a coherent electromagnetic field around your body that constantly reorients itself to the electromagnetic fields of the Earth and also ultimately of the planets and of the cosmos. That if your body is totally coherent in terms of the electromagnetic field it has, and if it's constantly, you know, reorienting itself in different locations in space and time to the electromagnetic fields of the Earth, so it remains in this coherent phase with the energies of the Earth and with the cosmos, then that's a state of zero entropy. No aging, the cells are perfectly aligned to the cells of the universe of which we are a part. But of course that doesn't happen all the time because, you know, we are disrupting our biological rhythms and there's so many factors that are influencing it. However, that's the scientific premise of what creates an aura. You know, in Vedic literature and all the spiritual literature, there is all this literature about an aura around a person. The aura is nothing but that electromagnetic field that's being generated. Different disease states, different kinds of auras, different states of awareness, different kinds of auras. But the healthier the aura is, which is, means the more coherent it is, then the more in alignment it is with the intelligence of the universe, the higher the state of awareness. The higher the state of awareness, the more access to that realm of creativity, that infinite mind, that cosmic mind that we have access to. So there are many techniques in yogic literature, in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, in the Shiva Sutras, the great ancient writings, which tell us about these auras, these subtle bodies, beyond the subtle body, the causal body, that are more in the realm of information and energy than in the realm of matter. There is another quality of the heart that is being measured right now, and it's called heart rate variability, which means that you measure the, and this is a little technical, you measure the RR interval. RR interval means the interval in an ECG between one heartbeat and the other heartbeat. And if this heart rate variability is increased, which means there's more chaos, then you're likely to have a more coherent electrical field. In other words, at the very, very basis of everything, there is a deterministic chaos. It's the deterministic chaos in that field of infinite flexibility, in the field of spirit, that ultimately creates coherence. Order comes out of chaos at very primordial levels. All kinds of order, physical as well as, you know, Nietzsche had this great phrase. He said, you must have chaos within you to give birth to a dancing star. And that's so true. Dancing stars are in fact born out of chaos. And Rumi, the great Sufi poet, was once asked, what's the secret? And he said, I'm in astounding lucid confusion. And it's also a state of liberation, freedom. So all this is measurable, and there are ways that your consciousness can influence this in the direction of chaos. You see that chaos is in response to the constantly and ever-changing dynamics of your body. If your heart rate was always 50 or 60, it has to respond minute to minute to all the different things that are happening in your body. More that heart rate variability at the primordial level, RR interval, the less likely you are to have an arrhythmia or anything like that. It's a prognostic factor. Okay, so that's a little bit about heart disease.
In this session, we're going to talk about cancer. When I was a young child, I used to imagine that there was a boogeyman who lived under my bed. And I was convinced that whenever the lights would go off, he would come right to the edge and was waiting for me to put my foot down. And so if I had forgotten to go to the bathroom, and I realized this after the lights were off, I would go to these elaborate measures to try to not touch the floor. So I would climb on top of the dresser, I would jump onto the chair, and then I would quickly as I could run out the door to get to the bathroom. And then on the way in, I would turn on the light. I'd go into bed, and then I'd call my parents and say, "Mom, I forgot to turn off the light." And they'd come in, and that way I knew that I was certain that the boogeyman would not be able to get me. I think that cancer is the boogeyman of our modern age right now, and that we have this fear that cancer is going to get us, and we often imagine, sometimes childish ways, that if we just don't pay too much attention to it, that we'll be able to avoid it. But the reality is that, unlike this imaginary boogeyman, the way to prevent and ultimately to eliminate cancer from our society is to bring the light of our full awareness into this area. So I'm going to talk today about what cancer means, what we know about it from both a scientific perspective and from a consciousness-based perspective, and then explore what we can do with our current understanding to really bring that boogeyman out into the open and ultimately teach us that it's not quite as scary as we thought it might be. There's probably not a person in this room whose life hasn't been touched by cancer in some way. Almost 3,000 Americans every day are actually given the diagnosis of cancer, and more than $100 billion a year is spent on this illness. An article that just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine this week showed that despite the fact that we have spent over $360 billion on cancer over the last several years, we haven't made any impact in the ultimate survival of people facing cancer. And brilliantly enough, cancer researchers are now starting to think, maybe we should put a little bit of attention on prevention. We've heard this expression for a long time, that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and yet really we've put absolutely no attention on avoiding cancer. And I think it's finally the time to recognize that our choices in life, our interpretations, our collective tolerance for toxicity is really ultimately what's going to make the difference in cancer. In fact, it's been said that there are actually more people involved in researching and studying and ultimately earning their livings on cancer than there are people who have cancer. So it's clearly time to make a shift in this. Now, what do we know? We know that probably 80% of all cancers have something to do with lifestyle choices or our environment. 30% of all cancers alone are just caused by smoking. So we could literally eliminate almost a third of cancers in this society just by getting people to seriously understand the effect that this toxic behavior has on their life. Of equal importance is what we eat. We know that increasingly the cancers of the digestive tract are a direct result of the type of diet that we in the West are taking into our bodies, and that by making fairly subtle shifts, we can really make a big difference in the incidence of cancer. So the question is, why is cancer increasing in this society? And I think the answer is on many levels. One is our tolerance for toxicity has increased to an unprecedented level. And so every time we drive in our car, we're contributing to cancer. Every time we use a disposable cup, we're contributing to cancer. Every time we refuse to buy a tomato at the grocery store that has a little spot on it, which means that we have to only accept fruits and vegetables that have been grown in an environment of pesticides, we're increasing our exposure to cancer. But recently, actually, there's this whole new understanding of these class of chemicals called endocrine disruptors. And there's hundreds of them in the environment, byproducts of exhaust fumes, breakdown products of pesticides, byproducts of factory smoke. And what happens is these estrogen disruptors are in our air and in our water, and they fool particularly the sexual cells. Testicular cancer is on the rise in men, prostate cancer is on the rise in men, uterine, ovarian, and breast cancer rise in women. And particularly in animals now, it's being very clearly shown that these new class of toxic chemicals is leading to a whole lot of strange cancers in the reproductive organs. And so it's another sense that our tolerance for this toxicity has gotten to an unprecedented level. And collectively, we need to no longer tolerate that in our personal lives and the things that we can change, and then collectively, which means that We need to be willing to buy organically grown fruit, even though it's a little bit more expensive. It has a few little brown spots on it, because that reduction of pesticides will make a difference ultimately in the health of our generation and generations to come. Also, the stress level that people are facing is probably unprecedented. So, as we've learned in previous sessions, that connection between the mind and the body, particularly the brain, the endocrine system, and the immune system, is making us less capable of identifying these cancer cells early on and correcting them. If no one smokes cigarettes, we've cut the cancer rate by a third right today. If everybody's incidence of ingestion of animal fat dropped, we probably cut the cancer incidence another 50%. So with just simple changes, stop smoking, reduce alcohol consumption, reduce the amount of animal fat in this diet, we would probably see cancer substantially reducing. But people have as yet not been willing to really make those subtle changes in lifestyle. But I think, as the recent articles are suggesting, this idea that, well, I can do anything I want, I can smoke, I can drink, I can eat lousy, and if I get cancer, I'll get fixed, that understanding is clearly not turning out to be the case. And so I think that we've just got to really highlight that we have a choice in what we're doing, and that our risk of cancer will be a direct result of those choices that we make. Now, what do we know about this illness, besides the fact that it scares us? Well, cancer is a transformation of a cell. A cell that's normally functioning can undergo certain genetic changes, and in those changes, it loses its normal control mechanisms. Because every cell in the body goes through genetic changes, almost any part of our body can ultimately succumb to cancer. But the parts of our body that have cells that undergo the most rapid changes are usually the areas that are more likely to develop cancer. So lung cancer, colon cancer, skin cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer, these are the parts of our body where the cells are going through a more rapid change. And therefore, if there's some abnormality in the genetic information, it's more likely to express itself. It's been estimated that probably at least 10,000 times a day, there is a potentially malignant change in one of our cells in our body. 10,000 times a day, there is a change in the genetic structure of a cell that, if left undetected, could lead to cancer. And it turns out that almost every cancer that we know about starts with one cell. And so what keeps us from normally not coming down with cancer is an incredibly elaborate system of identification, repair, and immunological surveillance. We have a whole elaborate system of repair mechanisms that instantly recognize when a cell has gone awry and then takes the steps to repair that genetic mechanism. There are specific genes that are involved in cancer, which we've recently recognized are particularly important. One of these genes is called an oncogene. Onco is the Latin word for tumor. And every one of our cells has oncogenes in it, which are really the genes that turn on whenever we need to reproduce that cell. So in the earliest stages of development, when we're just a one-celled being, half from our mother and half from our father, those oncogenes turn on, and they're responsible for this continuous multiplication of these cells, which grow into the organs and the tissues of our body. So we obviously need these genes to activate our reproductive mechanisms. But then, when the cell or the tissue has gotten to the right size, the oncogene turns off, and these other types of genes, these growth suppressant genes, turn on and are constantly monitoring the oncogenes to make certain that they don't come up unless we need them. When do we need them? Well, if you cut yourself shaving, then those skin cells realize that they have to repair that cut, and so the oncogenes come on, they create a few more skin cells until the damage has been repaired, and then the suppressant genes come on and turn off the oncogenes. So really, normal health requires that we have this continuous turning on and turning off of genes in our body so that we can deal with the changing environment that creates needs for repair. Cancer seems to be a problem with either the genes that turn the cell on or the genes that turn the cell off. If the gene that turns the cell on gets altered, gets changed in some way, then it turns on and it keeps producing its products even though there's no value to that. It's uncontrolled growth. If the gene that turns things off gets altered, then even though the system no longer needs that activity, we're not able to shut the switch off. It's as if the growth-promoting gene gets stuck in the on position. The first step in this process is this uncontrolled growth. But as I mentioned, 10,000 times a day we get these genes altered. So the second part of this process is whether or not our immune system is able to identify that something has changed in this cell and bring it back under control as quickly as possible. The terminology that's applied to this is our cancer surveillance system. It's as if we have these little immune soldiers checking IDs all the time, sort of like the hall monitors in your high school. And if you don't have the right identity card, then you have to go to the principal's office. When the immune system is functioning in a healthy manner, it's very quickly able to identify even these very subtle changes in a cancer cell, as a potential cancer cell. The problem, of course, with cancer is it's not like an invader from the outside that's obvious to identify. It's not like a tuberculosis bacteria, which looks so much different than normal that the immune system can instantly recognize it. It's really an invader from the inside. The cancer cell makes it just a subtle little shift, and it still has a lot of the normal identity markings, but it has something new. And the cancer cell is actually very good at hiding that newness. And so often the immune system will look at it and say, it looks a little bit funny, but okay, you've got the right idea, I'll let you pass. And when that happens, that allows for the cancer to take root somewhere, and then it may be too late until the immune system is able to fully identify it. And so on many levels, we can interfere with this process of cancer development. On one level, we can interfere with the level of toxicity that we bring into our system so that we can reduce these cancer-changing mutations in our genetic structure. And another level, we can substantially enhance our immune system by all the right behavioral choices and states of mind changes that can really enliven the optimal functioning of our immune system. So let's talk about it on both levels. What can we do to reduce the possibility of these cancer cells changing? As I mentioned, about 80% of cancers seem to have some environmental influence. And there's some obvious ones. So we know that if we smoke cigarettes, if we drink excessively, if we are exposed to certain types of potent pesticides like Agent Orange, that these toxic chemicals will directly alter our genes and increase our possibility of having cancer. But a lot of the other studies have shown that just changes in diet, things that we might not directly see as toxic, can have a profound effect. And a lot of these studies came from looking at the incidences of different cancers worldwide. So it turns out that in some cultures, one type of cancer is very prevalent. So for example, in the Western world, lung cancer is very prevalent. Why? Because such a substantial number of our population is smoking. But in other cultures where smoking hasn't yet invaded the culture, that type of cancer is very rare. What are the common cancers in our society? Lung cancer is probably the most important one. Second is colon cancer. What do we know about this? It's been clearly shown now that societies that have a very high animal fat and animal protein diet have much higher incidence of colon cancer than other types of cultures. This was first discovered actually in Africa, where there are certain cultures in Africa where you never see colon cancer. And if you look at what they're eating, it's because the vast majority of the food that goes into their system is derived from non-animal fat sources. In some of those cultures, though, there are other cancers which are very prominent. So liver cancer is extremely common in certain parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Why? Because there's a very high incidence of hepatitis virus there because of the poor sanitation. Hepatitis virus is something that can readily transform the normal cells in the liver and create cancer. So diet has become an extremely important factor in cancer. So let's go through the basic components of diet. Carbohydrates used to be a really important part of human beings' diets. In fact, in the past, probably we ate between 55 and 60% of our calories through carbohydrates, mostly through whole grains and beans. With the rise of protein, carbohydrates currently are probably less than 45%. And most of that has been replaced by animal fat. If you look worldwide, the countries that have the highest intake of animal sources of protein and fat always have the highest incidence of a variety of cancers, including cancer of the digestive tract, cancer of the pancreas, and breast cancer. And just by simply reducing the intake of animal fat and animal protein and increasing the intake of fiber, we can really make a substantial impact on many of these cancers. Now, how does it seem to work? One of the problems with animal fat is that as soon as it hits our intestines, it stimulates the release of bile acids and bile salts. The other problem with eating a lot of animal fat is that it moves much more slowly through the digestive tract. Bile salts, certain products of animal protein, and the fact that things move more slowly through the digestive tract means that these potentially cancer-causing chemicals spend an awful lot of time right up against the cells in our intestines. And by doing that, it has a much more likely chance of actually causing a change in the colon cells, resulting in colon cancer. So just by simply lowering animal fat, increasing the content of fiber, by increasing the content of vegetables and fruits and whole grains, we can substantially reduce the incidence of colon cancer. If you look at certain groups of people in America, like Seventh-day Adventists, who are primarily vegetarian, they have anywhere between a half or a fourth of as much colon cancer as other Americans. So it's clearly an important aspect. The other thing that we've learned about diet is that within fruits and vegetables are natural anti-cancer chemicals. These are known as phytoestrogens or phytochemicals, and there are a whole range of these which can be used to our benefit. There's probably about 15 different categories of these, and it turns out that each category has a particular effect on cancer. A category known as isothiocyanate, which is found in high concentrations in things like broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cabbage, actually block the ability for tumor-causing chemicals to change our genes. They actually protect the gene from these potential carcinogens. Something that I learned about a long time ago was a substance called flavonoids. And about 20 years ago, people were advertising vitamin C supplementations and suggesting that natural sources of vitamin C were better than synthesized sources of vitamin C. And the pure nutritionists would argue with this because they'd say there's nothing different about a natural source of vitamin C than if we just manufactured in our laboratory. But it turns out that natural sources of vitamin C almost always come with these other chemicals called flavonoids. And up until recently, we thought that these were just unnecessary, non-essential ingredients. But it turns out that the flavonoids, which are very rich in things like citrus fruits and apples and onions and beans, are very potent antioxidants and actually can block the effect of these toxic chemicals on our genetic structure. Other compounds, which are found, for example, in tea, are also potent antioxidants and can help us to avoid the toxic effects of cancer. So just again by favoring predominantly a simple reduced animal fat diet, we're getting in these natural anti-cancer drugs through the foods that we have. Another thing that we've learned is that there are many vitamins and minerals that have a very protective effect. The most important ones are what we call antioxidant vitamins. One thing that we've learned over the past 20 years is that probably the major reason that we get sick and eventually die is because living on this planet Earth, we all need to breathe oxygen. And in the process of breathing oxygen, every time we use oxygen, we create these molecules, which are called free radicals. And free radicals are not people who are left over from the 60s who are trying to change the government. Free radicals are these very active chemicals, which have a very short lifetime, but they quickly make a change in any protein or carbohydrate or genetic material that they find. They instantly bind with these natural chemicals around them and cause changes in them. Left to their own devices, they would rapidly cause havoc in our system. But we fortunately have evolved a whole class of compounds which quickly try to neutralize the effects of these free radicals. And these are called antioxidants. The major antioxidant vitamins, which are responsible for neutralizing these potentially angry, toxic chemicals, are vitamin C, vitamin E, vitamin A, and beta carotene. It turns out that each of these, which are of course richest in natural sources of plants, fruits, and vegetables, have the ability to scavenge these free radicals and to keep them from making their toxic chemical changes. So by increasing the concentration of these natural antioxidants, by increasing the concentration of these natural cancer-fighting chemicals, we can already make a substantial impact in reducing our risk for cancer. Now, if you read this literature, it's easy to become confused because almost every week someone is finding that another chemical that's found in broccoli or cauliflower or zucchini or another vitamin or another mineral is necessary to prevent cancer. And so the question is, how does Ayurveda, with its 5,000-year-old tradition of healing, address this issue of cancer? First of all, let's look at what cancer is from a consciousness-based perspective. If we look at it purely from the biochemical model, then it's some chemical change took place and this gene started reproducing and it led to excessive growth resulting in a cancer. But the question that Ayurveda asks is, what happened to that cell in the first place? And ultimately, a cancer cell is a cell that's lost its connection to the wholeness of the mind-body physiology. Like human beings, cells have purpose. They have dharma. And when a cell is functioning in a healthy way, it's fulfilling its dharma. When there's some toxicity in the system, then the cancer cell loses its connectedness to the unity value of life. And it begins to take on its own ego. It's as if the cancer cell is saying, well, I don't really feel that connected to the rest of this system, so I'm just going to start reproducing on my own. So a lung cell who's been so overwhelmed with toxicity over years of time decides, hey, this person's going to keep pouring this toxicity into me. Why should I care about the rest of these cells around me? I'm just going to start developing my own territory. So the cancer cell starts to divide, starts to reproduce, and basically takes on its own ego, not realizing that in the process of going beyond its normal healthy boundaries, it's actually sowing the seeds of its own demise. So what can we do from a mind-body perspective to reestablish that connection with wholeness? We can do things on a number of levels. One of the things that we've learned is that the cancer cell does not become completely deaf to the normal signals of the body. It just seems to be somewhat hard of hearing. So that it's not that it completely is unable to respond to these growth suppressing factors. It just doesn't respond in the usual concentrations. And so what we can do is we can raise the level of the conversation so that even the cancer cell can hear that message and restore itself to its normal functioning. How do we do that? Well, the first thing you have to do is reduce the level of noise in the system. So that if you're in a room and you're trying to hear a conversation and there's a lot of other noise going on, you're probably going to miss about every other word that's being said. If you quiet down the room, it's easier to hear the conversation. So, of course, the most important thing that we can do from an Ayurvedic standpoint is to regularly dive into that field of silence. Experience that state where the mind is quiet, where the body goes into that deep state of relaxation, which allows for the natural health-promoting chemicals of the body to reach every cell. The second thing that we can do is to bring our attention into our body. Many people with cancer, particularly once they've discovered cancer, it's as if they want to just completely wall off that part of themselves from their conscious awareness. And so through yoga techniques, through breathing techniques, through conscious visualization, we can actually bring our attention back into our body and enliven that area with our attention and our intention. Carl Simonton, back in the 70s, was one of the first people to talk about using visualization and creative imagery to enliven our healing process. Some of the earliest visualizations tended to focus around creating a battle zone. So the cancer cells were visualized as these enemy invaders, and we envisioned these troops coming in there and rounding up and destroying that. And although that image may have some value for some people, we've actually found that more often than not, it tends to create a sense of battle fatigue. And so what we recommend when we teach our patients visualizations is thinking about more harmonizing images We encourage people to go into a deep state of restful alertness and then introduce this idea that there's a healing energy, a healing light that can flow throughout the system, reach every cell in the body, and create that healing influence. So, and more people are really using the benefits of guided positive imagery to enliven the healing process. How can we use Ayurvedic approaches in diet to address the concerns that we've learned from Western nutritional science? Well, if you look at the six tastes and you have them represented in your diet, then it's very easy to see that those six tastes will provide all the necessary nutrients to make our system unfriendly to cancer. If you increase your intake of carbohydrates, what you're basically doing is you're increasing your intake of fiber in your diet, because all the things that carry complex carbohydrates are almost always associated with fiber. So whole grains, whole wheat, rice, these are the things that will automatically reduce the concentration of cancer-causing chemicals and increase those chemicals which are healing. If you look at what brings the sour taste into the body, it's usually going to be some natural source of organic acid like vitamin C. And we all know that Linus Pauling really was the foremost promoter of the value of vitamin C. So by making certain that vitamin C is in our diet, we're fulfilling the requirement for the sour taste. Salty, we don't have to pay much attention to, since we never have to worry about a deficiency of salt in a Western diet. It turns out that the pungent flavor, which is primarily due to certain essential oils, are carrying these very potent antioxidants. So things like horseradish and garlic and onions all carry this chemical called allicin, which has very potent antioxidant properties. So in the wisdom of the sages 5,000 years ago, this prescription to make certain that we have the pungent taste was at some subtle level a recognition that foods that carry that taste are protective against cancer. Bitter, most of these phytochemicals, these healing plant chemicals that are protective at many levels and help us repair our DNA, are carried in the bitter taste. So for certain that we have green leafy vegetables and other bitter vegetables, will be ensuring that we have adequate concentrations of these phytochemicals. And finally, astringent. Many of these very potent antioxidant chemicals are carried in beans and dals, and it's also a rich source of fiber. So again, if rather than having to worry about, am I supposed to be taking flavonoids or phenols or which antioxidants I should be taking into my body, if we just make sure that we have a balanced diet with all six tastes, we will be certain that we're protecting ourselves in the optimal way from cancer. So it doesn't have to be complicated. An important question to ask when dealing with cancer is, what is the meaning of this illness? And at first, when someone's bombarded with the diagnosis of cancer, it's hard to imagine that at some point down the road, they'll look back and say that that was actually a gift in their lives. But almost invariably, if you talk to people who have survived cancer, they'll say, this was one of the most important times in my life. And so what does cancer give us? It's an opportunity. At the time that someone discovers that they have cancer, it's almost inconceivable to them that at some point in the future they're going to look back and actually see it as a gift. But it really is a gift. It's an opportunity. In Chinese, the character for crisis means danger and opportunity. And certainly cancer is a crisis. But although it feels very dangerous and it's very threatening, it's also really an opportunity for personal growth and personal evolution. And so at the Chopra Center, there's really three questions that we ask people facing cancer to focus on. The first question is, what is the meaning of this illness in my life? It's a completely different question than, what did I do to get this? It's really, how can I use this illness to make changes in my life, to make new choices in my life that will bring me fulfillment? Very often when people look at cancer from that perspective, they'll realize that there's some aspect of themselves that they haven't really been willing to express. It may mean that there's something that they've wanted to do in their life, but they've allowed themselves to get locked into a job that's not fulfilling or a relationship that's not fulfilling. And so cancer, in a sense, is a way, it's an opportunity to allow us to recreate ourselves. If you ask most people, if you knew you only had 40 hours to live, what would you do? It's a rare person that would say, I continue doing exactly what I'm doing. If we really believed and understood that death was stalking us and that any moment we could change our experience from one of thinking that we have all the time in the world to realizing that every moment is a gift, we would begin to choose things in our life that are really fulfilling to us. So looking at your life and asking the question, what is the meaning of this illness? What is this telling me about myself that I haven't been paying attention to? What can I do to change? Is one of the opportunities that cancer affords. The second thing that we ask people with cancer is, who do you need to forgive? Almost all of us carry within our hearts some sense of betrayal or frustration or resentment from some experience in the past. It may be a relative that we felt didn't appreciate us. It may be an old friend. It may be an ex-spouse. It may be God. It may be ourselves. But cancer is a great opportunity to really look at what are we carrying in our hearts that's keeping us from being fully present in the moment, from being fully open in the moment, and then taking ourselves through the process of releasing and forgiving. It may be ourselves that we have to forgive more than anyone for choices that we made in the past. But cancer is the best opportunity that we know of to really encourage people to forgive anything from the past so that they can be fully present in the moment. And then the third question that we ask people with cancer to look at is, what kind of future would you like to create for yourself? What is your vision of the world to come? It could be that people say, you know, I've been in this occupation. It's really not fulfilling. I've always wanted to do something else. So cancer is that opportunity to start all over again, to really start to do something differently. It may mean that you're in a relationship that hasn't been fulfilling and you want to have a new vision of how to create that relationship in a way that's healthy. Or if you think that relationship can't possibly be recreated, then find a new relationship that will provide you what you want to do. It's possible that a person's vision is to create a peaceful, loving death surrounded by the people that are closest to them. By actually explicitly defining what that is that we're looking for, that is the way that nature organizes its energies to accomplish that goal. If we don't have any intention about what we want next, then we're not going to achieve it. One of Freud's brilliant statements was saying that the definition of insanity is continuing to do what we've always been doing and expecting to have a different outcome. And so if we use cancer as an opportunity to look at what our life is and then to say really honestly, what is the meaning of this? What toxicity am I still carrying in my life that I need to release? And how do I want to recreate myself to bring about the fulfillment and joy that I really feel that I deserve? This is the time to do it. Cancer is the time to do this. And again, what we've experienced very often is that whether or not you're cured from your cancer can be a healing experience. We've seen many people at the Chopra Center who have been able to go into total remission, and as far as we know, the cancer is no longer going to be an issue in their lives. We've also seen people who will die from their cancer. Just recently, we had a wonderful man from Colombia with liver cancer, metastatic liver cancer. He was told by his doctors that he had just a few months to live. Spent about a week with us at the Chopra Center learning meditation, which was really the first time that he felt comfortable just being quiet with himself, learning to express his emotions in a more open and loving manner, learning to just take each moment and enjoy it for what it is. He's a very ambitious businessman who, although was very successful, didn't have close connections with his family and his friends. And after his time with us, he went home and he died within a couple months, almost exactly on schedule. But his family wrote and said that the whole time that they'd known him, those last couple months since he was at the center, was actually the most enjoyable time of his life. It was the first time that he'd actually ever seemed to be happy with what he had, other than always thinking about what more he needed in order to be happy. So we consider that a state of healing, even though we didn't cure this person of his disease. Cancer can really be a beautiful opportunity for learning and for growth. And I'll end by quoting a wonderful woman that I took care of recently with breast cancer, who after going through the whole process and coming to that point of really being completely in control of her disease and the expectation is that she will no longer have to be dealing with the cancer, She looked back upon the experience and really felt that it was a transformational experience for her, that she learned more throughout that whole experience, which went on for about a year, than she had probably for the entire other 60 years of her life. And she said that what she had learned was that the soul grows from subtraction, not addition. The ego grows from addition. You know, we get a bigger job, we make more money, we have a nicer house, we have a bigger car. The ego loves that feeling of being puffed up by more accumulation. But ultimately, who we are is none of those possessions, none of those positions. It's that underlying spirit, that field of awareness. And cancer really gives us this opportunity to strip away all the things that are non-essential to our life and really get in touch with that essence, which is who we really are. And that reminds us that the ultimate truth about cancer is that you cannot have cancer. Your body can have cancer, but you, the real you, the infinite, eternal spirit, which is your essence, can never have cancer. And that's really the goal of any program that's designed to heal, which is just to bring you back home, to allow you to return to that state of wholeness.